Welcome to Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you. Good to be back, Teresa.
Good to have you here. Mm-hmm. Last week we had an interesting program discussing the history of the lineage, I guess, from after the kings and switching over to Mary Tudor and all the process
right.
from the Church of England. And then we got quickly into what was going on in Ireland and Scotland.
That's right, yeah. And they have a couple things to finish up with. Ireland in particular, we've pretty much talked about Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go back to Scotland a little bit later on with John Knox. But,
right.
But basically, I think we looked at that. We were looking at the quagmire of Ireland and remembering that geographically Ireland can be split basically in two,
mm-hmm.
With the Shannon River in the center. To the east is the lush and very rich agricultural Ireland. To the west is the more beautiful and rustic, but at the same time very hard living, hard scrabble living. And then we said also that Ireland not only can be divided geographically, but also can be divided ethnically,
yes.
because you have the native Celtic Irish themselves,
mm-hmm.
Who have been there since time immemorial, one of the few enclaves of this great Celtic people that at one time had inhabited Europe from Ireland all the way east to Turkey. And you have that group, and then on top of that, you have another ruling class, particularly on the eastern part, the rich part of Ireland, of what we called Old English. And these are Englishmen who had come over to Ireland since the Middle Ages, had settled, and they were the great landlords and basically the muckamucks of
mm-hmm.
Of that part of Ireland. And the coming of the changes that take place over in England with Henry VIII, then Mary, then Elizabeth,
mm-hmm.
This is the one group that it is most difficult for because they remain loyal to their religion. They're
okay.
loyal to Rome,
mm-hmm.
and yet at the same time, they're Englishmen. They're not
mm-hmm.
Irish,
mm-hmm.
and so they find themselves cut off. The first example of this are going to be where their sons are going to be sent to college.
Oh, that's right.
It's no longer theologically safe to send them to Cambridge or Oxford or one of the other universities in England because they've been taken over by Protestants. And so the religious education that they would receive would be adverse to their own experience back at home.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is most of them then are sent off to continental universities, Catholic universities in France and in Rome, certainly. Not too many in Spain that I'm aware of, but nonetheless, there you have, and many of them go to the new Jesuit universities and are taught by Jesuits. Some of them become Jesuits and will return to the Isles and be really part of the counter-reformation that takes place. More and more it becomes difficult in Ireland itself for these old English administrators, and they find themselves being replaced more and more by English administrators coming in, the Protestant administrators. And, of course, there's a lot at stake for England, for one thing. England cannot afford to drop the ball with Ireland or with Scotland, because in both cases, if those regions became either neutral or hostile to England, they are really a knife in the back of
mm-hmm.
England. You can imagine what a French army would look like in Scotland. In fact, during this period of time, several times French armies did arrive in the lowlands in Scotland. That's very, very dangerous for the English.
Yeah.
You can imagine the same thing, what it would look like to have an enemy poised in Ireland. The Sea of Ireland is not all that terribly wide, and that could be very dangerous too. So the Elizabeth is not going to allow anything to happen in Ireland that would allow that to happen. So you have more and more Protestant officials arriving in Ireland, taking over administration, and they have their own agenda,
mm-hmm.
interestingly enough. From what their point of view is that they want they're constantly writing back to London, we need more money, we need more soldiers, we need this, we need that. And the English are, you know, Elizabeth is pretty tight, and she's not real generous about these things. And what happens is that there's a vicious cycle that's set up in which these English Protestant administrators will cause violence to take place. They will press the Irish so far that the Irish then revolt.
Mm-hmm.
And then they turn around to England and say, we've got a revolt on our hands. We need more soldiers. We need more money. And that's how they got their stuff. But there's going to be a vicious cycle of violence that'll take place as a result of this. So that you've got oppression, rebellion, oppression, rebellion. And this will go back and forth. In fact, in 1579, a first really significant revolt takes place. And what happens with that is that Elizabeth will send an army of some 8,000 Englishmen over to Ireland to savage the land. And what they did was they got the ringleaders of the rebellion. They captured most of them. And then they tortured them and executed them in the most hideous of ways. It's a technique called hang, rack, and quarter. And it kind of describes the whole experience. They're going to be hanged, but not with a hangman's noose, so that they'll be stretched out. It's, of course, torturous, mm-hmm. but they won't die. Mm-hmm. And then what happens, you don't break a person's neck using the noose that they use. And then they're placed onto this torture equipment where their hands and legs are strapped down, and then they're literally stretched. It's the rack. They're literally stretched as far as can be. And then finally, the last act is actually the capital execution. And what they'll do is, in many cases, it's a low-tech solution. They simply take straps to your hands and to your arms and to your legs, and then have them tied to four horses that are then sent off in four different directions, and you're literally ripped apart.
Oh, my gosh.
It is a horrible, horrible thing. But I'll tell you what, it's a real quick way to end a rebellion.
I would imagine.
And as you can well imagine, you don't exactly win a lot of friends.
No.
Yeah. At the same time, Elizabeth sends this army of 8,000 over to brutalize the land. And if they thought it was going to be brutal, just wait until Oliver Cromwell in the next generation does it. At the same time, she also sends over preachers to try to Protestantize the Irish. They have absolutely no success at all. We'll see later on other attempts and how foolish those attempts actually were. And then she convinces some 4,000 Englishmen to move to Ireland, gives them all kinds of land and subsidies and all this in an ethnic cleansing program.
Mm-hmm.
It's an absolute failure because they simply don't have enough. 4,000 is not going to replace a population.
Right.
You know, the solution that will take place later on will be close to genocide. It really is under Oliver Cromwell. We'll look at this later on. But the Irish are going to suffer incredibly for their faith. And obviously, these situations bring up worse and worse history that's going to be part and parcel of the landscape even to today.
Then if we see and we look ahead, all of this oppression and has then leads later on to such a strong faith and where we end up getting all of our priests from Ireland.
Oh, incredible. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you have to go back to Tertullian. He's the one that said it, you know, and it's so true that the blood of martyrs is the seed of conversions. And certainly there was plenty of blood in this period
of
time. Yeah. That's about all I want to say on the British Isles right now.
Not too pretty.
And then we could shift ourselves back over to the continent, mm-hmm. and specifically to Geneva and
okay.
to Switzerland, because it's really now around this time that all these things are happening at the same time. That's why that timeline
mm-hmm.
is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But the emphasis that's going to take place now really is going to be yet another brand of Protestantism that'll be developing in Switzerland, and this is out of the efforts of of John Calvin.
Okay.
And it's interesting enough that really you can trace things back to 1517, which is the big Luther date,
mm-hmm.
and take a look at some things that are happening in another part of Europe, that being the city of Geneva.
Okay.
So at the same time that that you have the developments happening in Wittenberg and all, in Geneva there is a difficulty taking place because there are two spheres of influence that sort of overlap in Geneva, Switzerland. And one of those is political,
mm-hmm.
and the other is more economic and religious. And the one of those is the area of Savoy. The Royal House of Savoy has a lot of influence in the city of Geneva. At the same time, the city of Bern, which is a Protestant city, by very quickly becoming Protestant. Remember that Luther nails his 95 Theses in 1517, and some cities and some areas catch on very quickly to the idea. Bern is going to be one of the earliest. It's Bern, the city of Bern.
Now, where is Savoy in Spain or Savoy?
No, Savoy is in southern. Well, it shifts a lot.
Okay.
It's sort of the northeastern part of Italy, if you can imagine.
Okay.
France,
Italy, right.
It's sort of
sure.
like where France,
mm-hmm.
Switzerland, Italy all come together.
Okay, right.
In fact, today it's the royal house of Italy, the House of Savoy.
Okay.
And probably it's best known for the city of Turin.
Uh-huh.
And the family of Savoy are the caregivers, the keeper of the shroud of Turin.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And that's the same.
Okay.
But a couple, you know, but 400 years, 500
right.
years earlier, right? So anyway, there you had it. The city of Geneva itself is an episcopal city. That is to say, the bishop of Geneva is also the secular ruler. He owns that, or he holds that as a fiefdom to the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. So Geneva is technically an imperial city. It's also an episcopal city. It is a rather small city of about 17 or 18,000 people.
Oh, wow.
So it's not a huge mm-hmm. city by any means. But what makes it interesting is that the bishop has never had the kind of administrative control that you have in some of the other episcopal cities. Instead, he shares power or administration with a group of consuls. And there are different consuls that have different roles. The smallest of which is simply called the Little Council of 25, or the Syndics.
Okay.
And then you have another Council of 60, and then the Council of 200. And these are elected positions, and they do a lot of the administrating of the town itself. Now, what's important behind all of this is that tells us that the city of Geneva, more than most other centers throughout Europe, has a long tradition of democratic government.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
so the people who are citizens, not everyone votes, of course, you know, there are property restrictions and all that,
right.
but those who are able to vote then have a say in what goes on with the city. Power is shared then between the bishop, who acts as administrator for the emperor, and these elected groups. There's an old saying in the Middle Ages that city air makes you free. We don't tend to think that anymore. We usually say city air makes you sick. But
right.
But in the Middle Ages, city air makes you free. There was a sense of that if you were a burgher, you had some say
yeah.
over your own destiny.
Okay.
There is a lot of animosity going on at this time in 1517 between the bishop and the consul. Because the bishop is very much beholding, the Bishop of Geneva is very much beholding to the House of Savoy. And inside the city itself, there are a number of people who are set against him, wanting to do what they can to counter the House of Savoy and its influence. And they're known by their Swiss-German name as Eidgenossen, which sort of means like the Confederates.
Okay.
But what's more interesting, I think, for us, now remember, they're just political at this point, but the French-Swiss word that they would be using is Ujanol. Now, that doesn't mean a lot to us until we get over into French history, and there's this whole group called the Huguenots.
Oh,
right?
Uh-huh.
And Huguenots are French Calvinists.
Okay.
Calvinists. So here we have a political group, these Confederates, or the Ujanol, mm-hmm. that eventually are going to take on a religious dimension to them, too. And so what they did was they tried to use two other cities in order to throw off the Bishop of Geneva and the House of Savoy. One was a Protestant city, Bern, and the other was a Catholic city, Freiburg. Right? And so in 1526, they begin asking the city consul, the Consul 25, asks these two cities to send troops to help them to throw off the House of Savoy and the bishop, Bishop John. And this goes on. It's a very difficult situation that goes on for 4 years. It's not until 1530 that finally peace is restored to Geneva, and it's restored by the ouster of the bishop and of the House of Savoy. Now, the larger council, the Council of 200, still prefers the Catholic Church.
Okay.
And wants to keep Geneva Catholic.
Okay.
But this becomes very difficult because they've been liberated by an army from the city of Bern, a Protestant army, which brings in its own Protestantism.
Mm-hmm.
This is, remember, during this time we still have Ulrich Zwingli running around Switzerland, the Swiss Civil War between Catholics and the Zwingliites is underway. And on top of all of this, then, you also have a Frenchman who comes down to Geneva to begin preaching the new religion. And his name is Antoine Fromer. He's not too terribly important for us, but the important thing is that it's going to cause a crisis. And in the midst of this crisis, the bishop, of course, is going to flee. When he flees, he excommunicates everybody in the city of Geneva. And somebody said to him, he said, well, you know, there are a lot of good Catholics left in Geneva. And his response was, well, they didn't defend me well enough.
Wow.
And so there, you know, doesn't win many friends and influence people. and so there he goes. And in the midst of all of this, then, in comes none other than John Calvin.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll say some little things about him a little bit later on in his background, but by now he's become a real player. Calvin is a Frenchman, had studied at the University of Paris, the Sorbonne, at the same time that Ignatius of Loyola was there.
Hmm.
One would almost wonder whether they, you know, were in the same class.
Really?
You can imagine the debates that would go on. he had originally been... he had been a darling of his local bishop, who was encouraging him to go on in studies. Ultimately, the bishop and his father had a falling out and an argument. John Calvin was taken out of theology, put into law, studied law for a couple years, and then finally went back to his own theology. And he's got a very sharp mind. And eventually, he and a number of others at the University of Paris got into some trouble with these. They printed up big signs or placards in which they condemned the bishop of the bishop of Paris, and the government got on their case, and so they fled. And he's one who fled to Switzerland. Eventually, has an incredible influence over the people of Geneva, and in 1534. Had convinced, this was in the spring of 1534 when he returned to Geneva, convinced the consul to suspend the mass in Geneva itself.
Wow.
He's going to have to leave again. He's going to come back again. And when he's invited back in August of 1536, because of the chaos in the city, there's just no order in the city. When he returns in 1536, he's going to come in, and he is going to make sure that he is going to establish a church based on his own model.
Okay.
And he's got the power to do that now because the people of Geneva are so desperate to have law and order.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows how to lay down the law and order. First thing he did was he attacked the corporal presence of Christ in the Eucharist. This had been a long, argued battle. Remember the Marburg colloquy between Zwingli, Bucer, and Luther. Zwingli was arguing that Christ was not present in the Eucharist. Luther is arguing that he is present, but he doesn't know how. You know, and they had that big argument over that. So the Swiss solution of all of this, of the Eucharist itself, is going to be much more symbolic. And Calvin really takes that and runs with that all the more. The difference between this is that, sometimes you have this thing that when your argument is particularly weak, that's when you need to shout and wave your arms around. Calvin doesn't have to do that. He's very bright. Maybe that legal training he had shows him how to debate and pull together supporting arguments. And so he does. That's what he does. He has a very strong argumentative style, and he also quotes patristics. And using patristics, some of the writings of the early church fathers, he's able to convince people that the Eucharist is simply symbolic. So he's a very clever fellow. And by Easter of 1538, he goes so far as to convince the city of Geneva not to celebrate the Lord's Supper at the Cathedral of St. Pierre.
Wow.
You know, so, well, a lot of people were, they went along to a certain extent, but this was really pretty staunch stuff. And tempers flared and swords came out. Eventually, Calvin had to flee again from Geneva. And so he first of all goes to Bern and then to Zurich and then to Strasbourg. And while he's in Strasbourg, he gets another letter from Geneva saying, "Come back, we can't live without you." This is a very strange marriage.
Very.
You know? And so it's the Council of, it's the Assembly, the Council of 200 that invite him back. He comes back again, and this is the point at which he now is going to do what he wants because they don't know what else to do.
Mm-hmm.
He's 32 years old. He's young. He's energetic. He's bright. And when he appears before the city council, he says that he wants to have a committee. He needs a committee. He'll appoint the committee to draw up a church constitution. Here is the invention of a new church.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have, in a real sense, for the first time, there is no attempt to build a church on apostolic succession, for sure. Our tradition,
right.
There's no big T tradition concept. Even with Elizabeth, you know, she was so concerned about bishops and having window dressing of apostolic succession. Luther and Melanchthon spoke of a continuation of the Catholic Church in a small C.
Mm-hmm.
But here you have really the invention of a new kind of a church entirely. And what Calvin does is he says that, first of all, he sets up in his church what he would refer to as the four orders.
Okay.
And we'll talk about these in some depth a little bit later on. But basically the four orders are pastors. These will not be priests.
Right.
But they're ministers who are pastoring people. They're leading them. Doctors. These are the theologians,
okay.
Doctors of theology,
mm-hmm.
and then elders, and the term itself, elder, of course, is from the Greek presbyteron, and eventually John Knox will use that term then to name his particular church, Calvinist church, as the Presbyterian Church,
mm-hmm.
and then the last group would be deacons.
Mm-hmm.
So these would be the four servants, orders of his church. Pastors, doctors, elders, and deacons. He sets up in Geneva three parishes that will be operating with this, and they'll be frequent services, religious services, but certainly not the Mass. No attempt at a Lord's Supper or a Eucharist. Okay? And it's going to be heavily preaching and Bible-centered. And then catechetical classes, catechism classes will be all set up too. Okay. The city of Geneva found out very quickly that what they had invited in, they had some second thoughts about, but they couldn't get rid of him at this point. Calvin was really establishing a theocracy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God, this was going to be the city of God, and God was going to be the ruler of this city, and the one guy who knew what God wanted was, of course, John Calvin. He began to extend his authority throughout the city. First of all, questions of heresy. He would decide what was heresy and what was not. Well, okay, that sounds kind of theological. Then he also began expanding out to include adultery. He would try all cases of adultery. They would not be civil cases. They would be religious cases. And he would decide what was adultery and what wasn't. Blasphemy. He would decide that. So some guy goes walking down a church and stubs his toe, or walking down a street and he's in front of a church and he stubs his toe, or in front of a minister or a group of, you know, the holy women or whatever, stubs his toe and he emits a little expletive undeleted, and boy, he could be hauled in for blasphemy. Another area that becomes a real big deal, and we've seen this in Scotland already, is witchcraft.
Uh-huh.
You know, and also over here in America, the American version of all of this, of course, would be Puritans and the witchcraft that's set up. It goes beyond that, and he demands control over building construction in Geneva. He's going to be giving the building permits.
Wow.
He decides that that city defense is too important to be left to the city council. And so the church then assumes control of the city defense. Even fire protection. Taxation.
Wow.
Before you know it, I mean, he is grabbing all authority in the city of Geneva. And so in a real sense, Geneva does become a theocracy.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Did the council try to do anything to stop it, or are they too late? They've already.
They're too late. Yeah, they're too late. And in a real sense, there's an atmosphere that's set up in which everyone's watching each other and turning each other in. They even have in the catechism classes, people will be asking the children, like, what goes on in your home? Your parents, do they play cards? Are they sneaking a drink at night? And so the kids start telling on their parents.
Wow.
You know, I remember one time I was teaching a catechism class, and we were preparing the kids for a first penance. And we were going through some of the sins, you know. And you know how innocent kids are. And one of the kids starts saying, "Well, my daddy." And I'm going, "Shh, you don't need to say this, you know." But you can imagine how much information these catechism teachers could get out of kids. And, of course, that would be then turned over to these inquisitorial teams who would then go ahead and pursue this. So, really, Geneva became more and more a city that looked more and more like East Germany during the communist period.
Right.
You know, they had their own Stasi. One of the notorious cases that takes place is you mentioned about opposition. Not everybody rolled over,
right?
And but many of them were punished pretty good. One publisher, and Calvin will use Geneva to set up incredible publishing houses. Printing presses. Geneva becomes very famous for its printing presses. But one of the earlier ones in 1546 had a run-in with John Calvin. His name was Pierre Amiot, and Amiot found that there was more money in publishing printing cards than holy books and playing cards, you know, and for gambling. And so there was this big argument between the two, and I believe that in the end, Amiot was run out of business. Another case of Calvin excommunicating a prominent citizen, in another case refusing baptism to the son of a man who had been martyred for his faith. If you ran foul of John Calvin, you paid for it in one way or another. One case, he ended up having a conflict with the man that he had placed in charge of the Geneva Academy, and they had a disagreement over the book of the Psalm of the Song of Songs, and then had another disagreement over predestination. There's another run-in with Jerome Bolsick, who was a former Carmelite and left the Carmelites and became a Protestant preacher. He came to Geneva, and his theology and Calvin's didn't quite match, and he was sent packing. Another case of Michael Servetius, who arrives on the scene. I believe he's Spanish, actually, but he arrives on the scene, and he begins preaching a Unitarianism. And ultimately, he and Calvin go at it so bad that Calvin tries him for heresy and burns him at the stake.
Wow.
There were a number of people who were burned at the stake, beheaded. At least another four theologians were beheaded. Many others were exiled and sent away. At the same time, Calvin's able to get away with a lot of this because, as I mentioned, he really encourages certain industries. And Geneva becomes wealthy.
Oh,
so people will put up with an awful lot if they've got money in their pocket. And the two big industries really are going to be publishing, the publishing houses. And then the second thing was a newfangled object that was really catching on called the clock, the watch.
Ooh.
And the watch actually goes back to the Middle Ages in Nuremberg. Even in the Middle Ages, they had developed with springs and all this kind of stuff, a pocket watch, but you had to have a really big pocket. It was known as the Nuremberg egg, and it was about the size of an egg, but it could tell you the time.
Oh, neat.
And of course, as time goes on, you get better and better at metallurgy, better and better at miniaturizing all these things. And so, by Calvin's time, watches were becoming popular. Wealthy people could afford to own those. And in Geneva, the very finest watchmakers began. And don't we have that even today? I mean,
right.
Isn't Swiss, Swiss craftsmanship is famous. He's really one of the real founders and fathers of Swiss craftsmanship and all of this. Another thing, too, about Calvin and the spread of Calvinism is that John Calvin's writings are very, very clear, and you have a very clear organization. Everybody knows who belongs to what, and this idea begins spreading. And one of the keys in spreading Calvinist theology was up at the University of Heidelberg. And what happens is that up in Heidelberg, the elector of the Palatinate, his name is Frederick III of Palatine. Frederick III had some very interesting questions. He was interested in a sort of dilettante kind of a way in theological questions, and particularly questions of the Eucharist.
Mm-hmm.
And so he invited all of the Protestants to send him their best description of what the Eucharist really is.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sat down with some of the professors at the University of Heidelberg, and they decided which one made the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
And they chose John Calvin. So Calvinism is introduced to Lutherland, to Germany, by Friedrich III of the Palatine in Heidelberg. This becomes really important from English history, because during the reign of Queen Mary, remember that most of the English Protestants fled, and they fled to two or three important university cities. Mm-hmm. One of those is Heidelberg. And they're going to be introduced to a lot of Calvinist ideas. These then are going to go back to England after Elizabeth is now back in charge. And they're going to come back. They're going to be bringing Protestant ideas. But rather than bringing Henry VIII style ideas back, they're going to be bringing John Calvin ideas back.
Okay.
And so you're going to have the beginnings then of the Puritan movement, which will in the next generation is going to cause a big explosion with an English Civil War, and part of the dimensions of that will be a religious dimension.
Mm-hmm.
In France, the ideas of John Calvin are catching on among certain intellectuals. There's a real. This is all before the Council of Trent, or during the Council of Trent, which and during that long period of time, Trent is in session for in and out of session for many years because of wars and all. The Catholics throughout Europe are not exactly waiting for the documents to come to them from Trent. I don't think that they had a lot of hope for much coming out of Trent. They'll be surprised.
Yeah.
But they're looking around for something. And in many cases, these are Catholics in France that are looking at the theology of John Calvin and interested in perhaps taking some of those ideas of John Calvin in order to reform the church inside of France itself.
Mm-hmm.
And many of these are going to be members of the bourgeoisie. These are going to be city people who are business people who have some money. They can afford to buy some books, and they begin talking amongst themselves. And a lot of them quietly band together in services. You see them less and less at Mass, and they're going to be at homes or out in barns or out in the fields and having little services, sort of Calvinist kind of services. This is the government can do what it wants to try to rout this out. It's not going to be successful. And slowly, even members of the royal families are going to be influenced by this kind of Calvinist idea. These are now the beginnings, really, of the Huguenots in France. Give you an example. Even the King of Navarre, which is a little kingdom that's nestled between Spain and France, the King of Navarre, Duke Anthony of Bourbon, himself converts rather openly to this new religion. The daughter of King Francis I is going to be in favor of this new form of Christianity. Eventually, this is going to lead to a very bloody civil war. But Francis I, as we've seen already before, and we'll see later on, is something of a spoiler and is not real interested in religion except to do what he could to hurt the Habsburgs,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, means then that they're not going to be able to do what they need to do as emperors in order to move Europe back to a united Christendom.
Right.
So things are just a mess. At the same time that this is going on, if you go a little bit further north and to the east into the Low Countries, what is today Belgium and Netherlands and Luxembourg, again, you're going to have some of these Calvinists, particularly Englishmen, going into these areas and trying to proselytize. At first, they're not going to have much success. And the reason for this is that Charles V is emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and he is very popular among the Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
Lived for a number of years in the area. Besides all of his other titles, he is also the Duke of Burgundy. And the Netherlands is part of the what's called the Circle of Burgundy, and then there's a lot of prosperity, and so everything is fine. So they're not going to have much luck until, remember that he abdicates in 1555,
okay.
And when he does, he turns over the German part of his empire to Ferdinand, his brother, uh-huh. and the Spanish part of his empire over to Philip, the procrastinator's son, and Philip is very Spanish. Now, Charles is European. In a sense, he might be the last European.
Uh-huh.
He's just speaks many languages. He is as comfortable in Italy as he is in Germany. Loves the Netherlands, Burgundy itself, which is of course eastern southeastern France. Spanish. He's really cosmopolitan European. His son is definitely Spanish. He has a very strong preference. Although he had lived for 4 years in the Netherlands, he never caught on to the Dutch thing, and much preferred Spain, and spent most of his time in this incredible monastic pentagon, the Escorial, outside of Madrid. The Dutch then slowly began coming over to the ideas of Calvin. They were attracted to Bible authority. They were attracted to Calvinist doctrine. They were attracted to the democratic nature of the Calvinist churches.
Uh-huh.
This is where, remember, we at the beginning we talked a little bit about the city of Geneva having sort of a spirit of democracy
right.
in it. And this is part of what develops with Calvin. Although Calvin in Geneva itself dominates the city, then that's through personality. The church, the constitution, is based on the principle of vox populi, vox Dei. The voice of the people is the voice of God. And so if you have a vote, then the majority then would speak for God.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very different approach. I mean, the whole concept of God leading his church is, you know, the whole thrust is the exact opposite of the apostolic sense. Of you know the certainly the Catholic Church and even the Episcopalian or Anglicans look upon the apostles, or certainly the Catholic and Orthodox look upon the apostles and their successors as the true leaders of the church. They are the magisterium that teaches the church.
Right.
The Calvinist notion is going to be a bubbling up out of the majority votes of people. Well, all of these people will be coming in contact with these English dissenters, as we had mentioned before, and they're going to be influencing them. And outside of Heidelberg, they're not going to be terribly welcomed in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Germany is Lutherland. You know,
right.
They don't need to be reformed. Luther did it for them. And so there's a lot of conflict with these. Some of them will go ahead and join up with a Scotsman, John Knox,
uh-huh.
who has already done time on a slave galley
right.
for some
oh,
of his
yeah.
stuff. He now is, after he served his term, goes to Geneva and learns at the feet of the master, uh-huh. John Calvin. When Elizabeth I comes in as Queen of England, and very rapidly they begin to realize that England will not stay as a Catholic church, but rather as a Protestant church. Many of them return back to England to serve Elizabeth in one way or another, not realizing that she herself is going to have her own brand of Protestantism. We now hear more the term Church of England, or the
right.
Anglican Church. But the theology is basically going to be Catholic, you know. Two, in particular, arrive back at the universities fresh from their studies abroad. And one of them is a Thomas Sampson, who becomes the Dean of Christ College at Oxford. And then the other is Lawrence Humphrey, who is named as president of Magdalen College at Oxford. Remember, Oxford is a confederation of various colleges.
Mm-hmm.
So these are very influential intellectuals. And no sooner did they arrive, and they refused to use vestments at the Anglican services, saying that that vestments were a leftover from the Popish Catholics, you know, that kind of thing. And there's a conflict right away between Elizabeth and these guys who she had brought back to England, placed in very important positions. And here you have for the first time the term Puritans,
okay.
because it's their intention, Sampson and Humphrey, to purify the Church of England of its Popish tendencies.
Okay.
And vestments would be one of those. English Protestantism is going to be very high church,
mm-hmm.
but there's
mm-hmm.
going to be a real struggle for that, whether that's going to happen or not. John Knox also returns, and when he returns, he's going to go to the lowlands of Scotland. And there you're going to have all the strife that will be taking place with Mary Stuart, remember,
mm-hmm.
and her internationalism, and then also her problems with marriage and that sort of thing.
Right.
And so he's going to really be encouraging the switch from Catholicism to Calvinism in Scotland. And of course that brand will be Presbyterian, called Presbyterianism. Mary Stuart makes a very bad mistake by inviting the French to send an army over to Scotland. This is in 1560, or a little earlier than that. But by 1560, the French who had arrived, which was basically paid for by the House of Guise, and we'll look at them a little bit later on, they're sort of an ultra-Catholic family within France. And they're going to realize that they're out of their class. And so they withdraw their army from Scotland. With that, Mary realizes that she doesn't have enough support in Scotland anymore, and so she accepts English protection, which, of course, lands her in the Tower of London, mm-hmm. and ultimately and for her own death. Scotland, its parliament, then gathers together, now without a queen. They then abolish a papal authority. They abolish the Mass, abolish sacrament of penance, confession. They abolish bishops, and instead establish what they refer to as the Kirk of Scotland, K-I-R-K, uh-huh. the Church of Scotland, along Calvinist ideas. The local churches then are then shifted over into what was known as presbyteries, hence the name. And each local church then would be run basically through the principle of Vox Populi, Vox Dei, the voice of the people is the voice of God, so they would elect. And then there would be, throughout Scotland, there would be certain provinces set up. And in each of these provinces, then, you'd have like the election of an overseer, a bishop of sorts. They were known as superintendents, and they basically had the same authority that a bishop would have had, except no sacramental authority because there were no sacraments. And then there would be yet another assembly of representatives from each of the districts or provinces, and they would gather together in a national synod. And so this was the way in which this church would be run. And it's from the bottom up. Discipline within the church would be carried out through those superintendents. Mm-hmm. We see that, you know, that there's a certain amount of independence among these Presbyterians, too. And so in order to enforce the disciplines, you needed somebody to oversee all of that, too. Church lands and property would be kept by the church, the new church, rather than the state, which is kind of an interesting shift. And then, as I say, there was something of a freeze until Mary's death. And then after that, Scotland becomes predominantly Presbyterian. This takes place very, very rapidly. You know, when you're looking at the theology of all of this and you're getting into the minds of these people, I think the single most important thing to keep in mind is that from the Calvinist point of view is the absolute autonomy and unapproachableness of God. Mm-hmm. You know, Christian liberty frees them from law and from fear of damnation. You know, they believe that they have been elected. They're the ones who have been elected. But it's the fear itself that brings them to the realization of their own electedness. Okay. In other words, if someone is convinced of the enormity of God and the wormness of themselves. I mean, I'm nothing but a worm. I'm the lowest of the low. I'm an amoeba, and God is so great. And I'm just so afraid, you know. But I realize that the fear that I have of God and my own uselessness is itself God's gift. Then, in other words, I've been saved. I mean, that's the song Amazing Grace, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I once was lost, but now I'm found. Blind, but now I'm free. The law, then what follows afterwards, and these are, you know, very strict societies. what the law that follows afterwards is a rule of life, and we follow that because we have been saved. So it's a very different approach. Now, the Catholic approach, which will be really explained and put forth at the Council of Trent, that play between God's grace, His initial gift of grace, His invitation, and then our free will. You know, and God's gift of grace is an invitation to give an invitation to Him to come into our lives. And then our working out of our salvation is a constant relationship with God. And we grow deeper in God's grace through our actions, through our acts of love. You know, and that's a very different theological approach than what we have here. What we're having with John Calvin instead is this sense of God's grace coming in and overwhelming us. The we know that we've received the grace because of the fear that's been instilled in us, and that this then gives us that motivation to live a good, simple Christian life,
But in the confidence of knowing that motivation to live a good, simple Christian life, and but in the confidence of knowing that we know that we've received the grace because of the fear that's been instilled in us, and that this then gives us that motivation to live a good, simple Christian life, and but in the confidence of knowing that we're elect.
Yeah. Well, what about the sense of God's grace coming in and overwhelming us? We know that we've received the grace because of the fear that's been instilled in us, and that this then gives us that motivation to live a good, simple Christian life, but in the confidence of knowing that we're elect. And making sure the mass schedule is set, and then preaching on top of all of that, and trying to, you know, find a way to get enough money to keep the school alive, and, you know, all those things that a Catholic pastor does. The Calvinist pastor, all he does is preach. That's all he does. The doctors theologize. It's the elders who really care for the finances and the administration of the property and all of the things of that nature. And then there's a whole class of deacons that then go out and care for the needs of the members. Different kind of approach entirely. And then, of course, you have other auxiliary groups. Like, for instance, you're going to have ministers and deacons who inspect the community for its faults. So you've got an inquisitorial inquisition that's set up. I'd mentioned already about, you know, members reporting on members, children reporting on their parents, heretics banished, burned, all those sorts of things. And all throughout, you're going to have whether it's in Geneva or Scotland or New England, this is going to be the function of the church. Interestingly enough, there's early run-ins with Anabaptists. The Anabaptists are obviously not going to be welcome in Catholic countries because they deny children's baptisms. It's not going to be welcome in Lutheran areas because Luther also adheres to infant baptism. And they're going to be cropping up wherever they think they can and have a little bit of freedom. And so they think that they can do this in John Calvin's areas. And that turns out not to be true either. The Anabaptists have some real problems right at the very beginning. Many of them, besides denying infant baptism, also believe in the communal ownership of property. Very radically so. And so they are, in fact, a 16th century form of communists. which is going to throw a lot of people for a loop. And then also, more than enough, are doing a lot of reading of the Old Testament and coming up with the idea of polygamy.
Oh.
So, and then...
starting to get out there.
Yeah. And then you're going to have others that are going to be anti-Trinitarians, like, for instance, Michael Servetus, really founders of Unitarianism. And all of this is going to be cropping up in Calvinist areas. And, of course, the church, the Calvinist church, is going to be suppressing this as much as possible also. So all of this is happening. You have a very rapid spread through Europe of the Calvinist ideas. Interestingly enough, one of the reasons is that many of the Calvinist preachers are former monks, former mendicant monks, Franciscans and Dominicans, who leave their monastery, come over to John Calvin, and because they're mendicants, they're kind of used to a living on the margin kind of a life, and so they move around. They don't need a lot of stuff themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They generally don't have families. They don't marry, as opposed to many of the Lutheran ministers who had been priests who took wives, as we've seen with Ulrich Zwingli before they even left the priesthood, and but they don't have that, and so they move very rapidly through Switzerland, France, the Netherlands, Scotland, England, all of these areas then take on a lot of Calvinist leanings.
Wow,
yeah.
That was a quick move across the continent, I would say.
It was. I mean, you're talking in terms of maybe a decade,
a
very, very rapid. Yeah.
And let's see, Trent was called in 44?
Right, and ends in 63, I believe.
63.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so this will be taking place like at the beginning of what's happening with Trent, right before Trent and the early sessions of Trent.
Uh-huh.
We'll be talking a lot about the Council of Trent. It's just a real important council.
Yes.
And taking that apart. But really, Trent is... well, I was about to say that Trent is backloaded in that a lot of the good stuff comes out at the end, but actually that's not entirely true. A lot of the good stuff happens at the beginning. As it develops.
So where do we go next week?
Well, next week I want to sort of like pull all of this together around Charles V.
Okay.
It'd be good to look at him. I'm going to subtitle that one, A Man with Too Many Countries, because he just had too much to do, and he couldn't keep up with everything.
Right.
So it's going to be a kind of an exciting ride of watching this kid. I think he was 19 years old when he first started inheriting the biggest empire in the world. And... we're going to watch him go throughout this whole period of time trying to be the good emperor, the good Christian emperor in traditions of Sigismund and Charlemagne and Otto the First, and trying to do the right thing, and at the same time being harried from all sides and not able to do what he ultimately had hoped to do, which would have been to bring back together, to reunite the Christendom. And so I think this would be a good way of looking at him. And then with that, begin moving into... Well, first of all, we're going to have to say something about the first terrible clash of Christians killing Christians in the name of Christ.
Okay.
And that happens in Germany. That's the Schmalkaldic War.
Okay.
You know. So we'll take a little look at that. And then start looking at Council of Trent, and start looking at the incredible Catholic saints.
Mm-hmm.
There is, following this generation that we're talking about right now, there is an incredible growth. I mean, there's nothing less than a tidal wave of saints that take place in this next generation. And spend some time looking at them, addressing the questions of reform. Okay.
All right.
So that's what we're looking at.
That's great. Thank you very much, Father. A quick prayer to close today?
Sure. Well, why don't we pray that great doxology. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be,
world without end. Amen.